Have you got both numbers working, David?
Hello.
Hello.
Can you hear me? This is Candace. How y'all doing?
Just fine, Candace.
Hey, Candace.
Hello. Hey, Candace.
Hi there.
Hey, Candace, Brian Faisenbaker here.
Hi.
Alonda, this is Billy. How many people are joining, on the phone?
Everyone but Haynes on the council are joining by phone, and Susan, John, and Will are here. So eight of the nine of you are by phone.
Did you say eight of the nine are by phone?
Yes.
Got it.
Hey, this is Kevin Carroll. I'm here.
Welcome, Kevin.
How are y'all?
This is Mike Brady. I'm here.
Well, we will take
Brian Faisenbaker's here.
Yeah, we'll take roll call in just a second. It's only 11:58, so we'll wait 1 minute before we take roll.
Kevin, this is Billy. Did your daughter get settled in Memphis?
Yeah, we're actually going to be moving around this coming weekend. I appreciate all the help and assistance with everything.
Where did she end up landing? I can't remember where she ended up.
Chiska.
Living.
At the Chiska.
That's going to be great. Yeah, that's great. There's that's a good location. Those are good people.
Yeah, she's really excited about it.
And, I'm sorry we didn't have anything at my place.
No, don't worry about it. I figured I'd reach out to you first since you know all the ins and outs of the town. But yeah, I definitely
appreciate
it. If she needs anything ever.
You don't need to worry about Billy because he would have overcharged you on the rent anyway, so it's probably good you found a different place.
Did y'all know that Mike's wife makes love out their pool house? I didn't want to bring that up, but hey, if she needs anything, Candace is actually nearby, because she works right there, a block away. I work three blocks away, and Mike, do you work, Mike? I can't remember, but anyway, but we're all.
I don't know if you're ever in town, Billy.
Well, yeah, I really appreciate everybody there.
I love
the system. Yeah, I think they did a great job. And that's the restaurant on the bottom, Andrew Michael, is fantastic. I mean, Catherine Mary.
Yes. Catherine Mary.
And if Candace would ever get the Grizzlies back playing live, we could go over there after the game. I think we're past 12. This is Billy Orville. This is the Sports Wager Advisory Council meeting. It's August 18, 2020, and it's 12:02 Central Time. And let's call the meeting to order. And I think Haynes is there. Haynes, do you want to call the roll?
Sure. Well, we know you're here, Billy. Brian, are you here?
Brian Faisenbaker's here.
Okay, John. John Baggett? No.
I'm here.
Oh, he is. Candace?
Here.
Kevin?
Here.
Michael?
Here.
Sam Lee?
Here.
And Tom Lee?
Present.
Okay, we're all here.
we have a forum. Thanks, Haynes. And I was going to say, I noticed everybody's doing it. Sometimes it gets noisy because we're probably working from somewhere else. All the, they try to use the mute on your phone if you're not speaking, and it'll probably be better for Rebecca and Haynes and Alonda and everybody that's and Susan that are sitting there in the office. So what the next order of business would be the approval of the minutes from our June 15 meeting. And I want to see if there's any corrections or additions to that.
I have a correction. just that my name is spelled incorrectly a couple of times in the document. But the things that it said about me were true. Misspelling of my name. And I think it starts at the top, it's short with a T. But other than that,
thank you, Candace.
You need to be a good steward of your name.
That's right.
Spell it correct.
That's right. We'll see if it doesn't happen again.
No worries. I'm so used to it being my first name that's misspelled that I didn't, you know.
Does anybody else have any corrections? If not, please let's correct Candace's spelling. If not, do we have a motion for approval of the meeting minutes from the June 15th meeting? So that's John Valiant. Got you. So John moved to approve. Sam is second. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The motion carries. The minutes are approved. Next, Rebecca, how are you? And we're going to call on you for item four, the sports gaming implementation update.
Thank you. But before I do that, I'd like to introduce two people who have joined our staff since the last meeting, who are spending 110% of their time doing sports wagering. I called Billy and Tom. Jennifer resigned right after the last meeting for a wonderful opportunity at a company called GameCo. And that same day, we were in the process of hiring Danielle Boyd to be our vice president of sports gaming. And Danielle was the general counsel of the West Virginia Lottery at the time that they implemented sports wagering, and was responsible for the implementation of sports wagering at the West Virginia Lottery, and she left there to become the national government relations person for William Hill. So we feel very fortunate that she has agreed to join us. Do you have anything you want to say?
Really excited to be here. So thank you all for the opportunity, and really excited to get to work. I know we've got a lot of other crazier things going on historically right now, but the idea of getting to be a part of this program and also a little bit of history and implementing the first open license mobile program in the U.S. is really exciting, and I'm ready to get to work. Thank you.
She started the 1st of July, so she's been here a little while and has been instrumental in what we've gotten accomplished thus far. And then I think I told you at the last meeting we had hired Danny DiLorenzo. Am I close, Danny?
Yes, ma'am.
Oh, good. So Danny's with us, and he is a, I guess now since he joined us, a former Secret Service agent, and did a number of financial investigations, including illegal wagering and gambling things. So we feel very lucky that Danny has joined us as well. And they are our two employees that are 100% dedicated to sports wagering, although Alonda spends 95% of her time on sports wagering and the other 95% of her time general counsel, working lots and lots of hours trying to get all this done, and the other parts of the team doing sports wagering, including Andy Davis, who you've met, and Christy Steckline, who you met, and then a whole bunch of other folks who have been helping and working. I think Karen thinks her full-time job is sports wagering now too as well, even though she's in charge of minority contract compliance. So with that introduction of the new folks that are here, I'll bring you up to date on where we are. We have received 4 operator applications that we have now deemed complete. The contents have been reviewed internally, and we've submitted the financial information to our third-party vendor, Hoskins, and we're in the process of completing the individual background checks through TrueView and the TBI. We had introductory calls last week with each operator to discuss each of the applicants' initial launch plans. The purpose of the call was to discuss timelines and other issues most pertinent to a go-live date. We will likely schedule several follow-up calls to finalize individual plans for launch in the near future. We did the calls with a script so that each and every operator got the exact same information. And Alonda and Danielle were on the call with our internal auditor present to just document what questions had been asked and make sure that every operator has the same information. In terms of suppliers, we've received 5 supplier registration applications to date. The contents, again, have been reviewed internally, and we've submitted the financial information to Hoskins, our third-party vendor, and we're in the process of completing the individual background checks through TrueRoo and the TBI. We have a number of vendor applications, and we continue to receive them daily. We're working with the individual operators to make sure that the vendors, if they are going to deem as necessary for them to be ready to go live, are received and prioritized. We have 18 vendor applications on the agenda for the approval at the board meeting tomorrow. We are working on developing and publishing additional directives and guidance for operators relating to geolocation, statewide self-exclusion, wagering categories, approved events for wagering, change management, and other issues that are relevant for us to be able to have a go live date. At this point, we have told them that we would like to go live no later than November 1st, and we will start earlier if everyone is ready. So with that, we'll answer any questions you all might have.
Are there any questions?
Mr. Chairman, this is Tom Lee. First of all, to Andy and Danielle, welcome. We have a law firm has an office in Charleston, West Virginia, DuBois, and we have an excellent reputation received you from my colleagues at Crosstown Pilot in Charleston. They spoke very highly of your work in West Virginia with the lottery and enjoyed working with you very much. So welcome. Delighted you're here.
Thank you so much.
And it's a good thing you have no relationships with the Secret Service.
I did learn as a reporter to respect Secret Service, and then after a while they give you your time. Not at first, but after a while. So that's good. I do have just a couple of questions. I know the statute requires the fairly difficult task of approving or making a decision, I should say, regarding the approval of a completed application within 90 days. Could you give us a ballpark, Rebecca, as to when these applications were deemed complete, and so how that, just to give a sense of how that process is likely to go for us?
Yesterday.
Excellent. All right, well, that's timely.
We wanted to try and get them all completed before this council meeting. And so we got everything we needed from everybody and sent them letters yesterday that their applications had been deemed complete. However, we would hope to be ready earlier than the 90 days.
Did we have any applicants who were unable to submit completed applications?
The only issue were getting fingerprints because of the COVID-19 issue. So we are working with the FBI. I don't know, Danny, if you want to answer this if I'm misspeaking, but they were working with the FBI to get electronic fingerprints sent so that we can get that portion done. But I think that's the only piece that we've had issues with is actually getting fingerprints taken. We worked through that with the TBI, the FBI, TrueView and Danny to make sure that we got what we need to deem them suitable to do business in Tennessee.
Thank you, Rebecca. Welcome again, Danielle and Danny. But Mr. Chairman, those are my questions. Thanks very much.
Are there other questions on item four? Both of you, welcome. Danielle, I'm gonna say I was in West Virginia and I saw FanDuel or one of the people had a viewing area and a place you could place your bets. I think it was mobile, but they may have had a person there to help you do it at the Greenbrier. I thought it was very well done, and I don't know what if we'll end up doing something like that or make it a place where you can sit, watch, and then do it on your phone or your device. But I thought you guys, if you were around for that, did a great job in West Virginia. That was the only one I saw. I didn't know how many locations there were, but I was impressed. And there wasn't, if I remember correctly, I looked at the board there at the time I was there. There wasn't much to bet on, so it was more watching reruns on ESPN, I think.
Thank you so much. That's definitely probably one of the rinsiest sports books in West Virginia, and the Greenbrier Casino is certainly a sight to be seen. So thank you very much. It was we had a lot of fun implementing that program there and being able to do that. So I'm glad you enjoyed yourself there.
Yeah, it was well done. Yeah, it was well done. All right. Do we want to move on with no other questions to item number five, which would be, Susan, the discussion regarding compliance directive for operators on the rule governing cap payout?
Sure. So that's the directive that was published, I guess. It's behind tab three. Just a little bit of background, and there's not, I don't think, a lot to discuss, but I think it's helpful to remember kind of how we ended up here. So as you know, we have a 10% hold or a 90% cap, however, whatever the semantics are on that. And that's an annual aggregate rule. And we talked, I believe, last time about the penalty for that. And of course, we want the penalty to be meaningful. But the statute prescribes what the penalty maximum is, and that's $25,000. And we talked a lot about, was there any way to, you know, put more teeth on that or make it somewhat more of a deterrent, if you will. And we don't believe under the statutory language, and I think Danielle and Alonda agree with me and Will on this, that there's really not a way to impose a stiffer penalty than $25,000. Now, if we get to the end of this first year and all of our operators are happily paying their $25,000 and violating that hold, then we may have to try to figure out another way to enforce it. But my expectation is that these folks are going to come in and try to do what they're supposed to do and adhere to the rule and comply with it, and we don't expect there to be any issues. But we did want everybody to understand going in that the $25,000 is what the statute permits, so that's what we've proposed and directed. Does that cover it, Alonda?
Yes, it does. Sorry.
Any questions?
Are there any questions from the board on that?
Stanley, I have a question. So I'm just saying, go ahead. We don't. I'm just wondering why we also don't include the first prong of subparagraph B, where it says suspension, and we include suspension in there along with the $25,000.
I can answer, or you can, Danielle.
Whatever your preference is, Director.
We believed that if we said, if you don't reach this, you'll be suspended, that we would limit the number of operators we have, because if they have a license suspension here, then they've got issues in every other jurisdiction that they do business with. So that's, you know, the death penalty year one. Right now, you've got an issue with, as you noticed, Billy, when you were in West Virginia, without the kinds of sports that are known, they're struggling with what their odds should be on Eastern European table tennis. So we thought for the first year, we would do a $25,000 penalty, and if everyone is way over that on purpose, as opposed because of some event, then we will deal with it in the second year. And I've been assured by Danielle and Danny and others who have done business with these folks for a very long time that they'll want to be in compliance, and they will try to be as close as they can to what the rules and regulations say. If that's not the case, then certainly, you know, if they all come in at 98%, we'll assume the board will take a look at, you know, whether or not the death penalty is appropriate.
And you'll see that that is kind of what we imply, or I think intend to apply in the last paragraph under reservation of right, you know.
Danielle, do you want to add anything to that?
No, I think you've done a terrific job in explaining it, Madam President. I'll just add that, you know, from an industry perspective at large, I think that, you know, everyone has largely accepted this is going to be the way of doing business. And really, it's just looking for additional guidance on how it might be enforced so they can work out their business plan for Tennessee. This is a terrific market. Operators are excited about entering the market here. And I think that, you know, with this and them knowing it, what this fine has been outlined as, and them not being overtly concerned necessarily that in this first year, so many anomalies, and also just the general volatility that we can see with the sports betting market, just given the nature and the margins of it, they'll be able to try to hit that 90 right on the nose. When they're doing their trading and their risk management, you know, overall as a program, they're going to try to hit that dead on. And as opposed to if I think their license may be threatened and they had to worry about having to report things in different jurisdictions across the U.S., you know, everybody's struggling with cash right now because of limited betting options, I think, to some degree, or at least with their offerings. You know, they're going to come in at trying to hit probably 80 or 83% on that cap of their trading, which means we're probably going to get less competitive pricing and a lot of parlay type offerings. And so with this, I think that, you know, certainly they are going to take the responsibility seriously to comply with all of the regulations, but also this will give them the ability to kind of plan and tailor their risk management program around hitting that 90% right on the nose at a minimum.
Well, so this is Sam, just in response to that, I certainly appreciate the rationale there from the business perspective, but I guess my concern is that 15.1.9 is pretty clear about 90%. We went through a lot of undulations with the legislature about getting that number there and making it solid. And I think if we have only a monetary fine, then it just becomes a mathematical calculation on cost benefit. You know, I mean, if we're going to make $100,000, it's going to cost us $25,000 to pay the penalty, then that's no big deal. I think we should at least consider, you know, suspension to me is not the death nail, because it's suspension, not revocation. And it's not something that can't be reversed if some corrective measures are in place. But I think that just making it a straight monetary fine, and especially in this business, gives them a lot of latitude to just do a cost-benefit analysis, and it doesn't put the teeth in complying with that very strict directive that we crafted at 90%.
Billy, this is Susan. I guess it would be helpful for the board to sort of hear from other members of the council about that, so we can take that, you know, does everybody agree on that? Do we have differing opinions? And then we can take that to the board, I guess, and make a final call.
Hey, this is Mr. Chairman, this is Kevin Carroll. I completely agree with everything that Sam is saying. You've got to have some teeth on the back end of it. Otherwise, like Sam indicated, it's just a cost benefit analysis for the company.
Mr. Chairman, this is Brian. I agree with Sam, and
an argument. The fact that I think it's important to set the expectations on the front end going into this thing, as far as them understanding that suspension is certainly on the table. $25,000 to the players in this program is really not much.
Anyone else? Haynes?
This was Billy. Let me ask you a question here. I was reading the, and I know you just did it for example only, on the chart here. Explain what you were trying to do on the chart with the percentages and the hold. Is that the penalty amount that you were, that we were recommending, or is it what I think Sam or Brian said that they would just make a, I can't remember who said it, or Kevin, that they would just make a business decision on the cost benefit, and that's what you were trying to show.
Danielle?
It was just for example purposes only, for just to give examples of how it would be calculated and then looked at for the various percentages that were at 10% or I guess below that. But I can see how that might be confusing, but it really was just for example purposes only to give, a calculation example.
You said that. I was just trying to, I think it gets to what, I think, Kevin, sorry, but I think it was just the thing that trying to say that, well, what's 25,000 if we made an extra 5,800? So, I think that's what it illustrates.
We were at one point considering trying to figure out if there were a way to increase the penalty based on the gap, if you will, and that this was in here initially, honestly, because of that, and we sort of realized we couldn't. So, Billy, let me just again make sure I'm understanding. It wouldn't be an, you all aren't suggesting an automatic suspension. Are you sort of talking about facts and circumstances kind of consideration? Or Sam, are you suggesting automatic suspension?
No, I think what you're saying is right. I mean, I think in line with the language that there is that the board may impose an administrative fine. I think, you know, if you read 4-51-326, it outlines two possible scenarios in there. One is the $25,000 fine, but the other is also suspension, revocation, or refuse to renew a license. So I just think that we should put it on notice that is a very distinct possibility. I mean, that might be something that you want to discuss further with the board as far as whether it's summarily done or there's some kind of process there. But I think it's something that takes that business calculation out of it, the cost-benefit analysis out of it. Like the chairman said, if you're going to make $5 million more, then, okay, we'll pay the $25.
Great. That's very helpful to me.
I don't have a question, but I guess it is a question. So I'm reading the section on reporting. So if I'm reading this correctly, you all will know monthly pretty much what they have and are able to kind of, will be able to communicate that information to them in a way to kind of, you know, as it gets closer to that, you know, December 31st day, so that they'll know it and it won't be a surprise. You all will be getting that information monthly, is that correct? At the very least, I know they said daily, weekly, or monthly, and monthly, but.
Yes, we will have, they will be connected to our financial reporting system, and we will be able to see that and discuss that with them. However, if we start November 1st, we probably won't hold them to that this January 1st. So there has been some discussion of that being from the day they go live to 365 days later, which takes it away from the January 1st to December 31st calendar year at this point. So there are still discussions about when that will happen, but to your question, Yes, we will know on a, I think a daily basis, right, Andy?
Correct, and they will have to certify it on a monthly basis, but we get the data daily.
We'll get the data daily, they'll certify on a monthly basis.
Correct.
Okay. And is there some opportunity to kind of have a conversation and see what the, what, I guess what the plan is, if they're not trending towards having that?
Certainly, but, you know, there might, maybe, you know, depending on, circumstances, there could be a single event, on New Year's Eve, if we were, you know, kicking it in December, you know, January 1, you know, if Tennessee were in a national championship game on December 31st, the betting would be so off whack if they won it. I know, but let's say if University of Memphis, then.
let's say.
So, you know.
No, I think we're just
thing. Or Butler, don't forget Butler.
But we don't play football, so. But we do have an esports program.
That's true.
So.
Tip of the basketball.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, I think we need the flexibility if there's a single event so close to the end of the year that they're on target, and then a single event. You know, the first year Rhode Island did sports betting, they lost $4 million because the Patriots beat the spread in the Super Bowl, and everybody in Rhode Island, since that's where their practice field is, bet on the Patriots, and the lottery lost $4 million on a single event. So we need to, you know, be able to have the flexibility not to, and I know suspension is not the death penalty, Sam, but the problem is they have to report that in every other jurisdiction. So it depends on how a suspension in Tennessee would impact their licenses in all the other jurisdictions they do business. So that's really our issue, in not wanting something that hurts them quite that badly. But we can look at,
I think, having it as a potential.
Yeah.
As long as we've got the discretion that if it's a unexplained, but if they've been going along for 6 months and we've had conversations with them and put them on notice and they continue, then that's a whole different conversation. So I think it's a great idea.
Okay.
This is Tom Williams. Oops, can you hear me?
Yeah. We hear you, Tom.
Oh, okay, thank you. I wonder if there isn't, on the range of ways to address this, a middle ground. We're a little hamstrung by the statute, but the statute does say, as Sam rightly pointed out, with respect to fines, it's $25,000 per violation. And I wonder if there might be another way or some ways that we could think about what we mean by a violation. So if being over is a violation, then yes, I think $25,000 is de minimis and everybody would blow right past that once. And then the legislature might tell us to do something different. And we might see a cap in statute. If, however, you think about a violation as an event that occurs each day or each week or each month, then $25,000 times something begins to become more material. And certainly times 365, you begin to get people's attention, I should think. But that requires maybe nothing more than the reporting that, Rebecca, you anticipate that we will have in place already that would allow us to measure. Because I'm with you in that I don't want to see a company lose a license because they have a day in 365 where they didn't manage to this number. I remember when we talked about putting a cap on at some point, we talked about a cap that would be measured over the course of some time, and I guess now we're thinking about calendar year 2021 would be the first year that we would do that. Maybe we can even talk about some kind of rolling average, if I remember. I don't remember how that ended up in the rules, I'm afraid. But all of this is just to say, if a violation is missed for 2021, or a violation is every single day you're over, then the math might be more persuasive with respect to fines. It might also be, frankly, something that you might want to consider asking the legislature for some assistance on, because there's an enormous gulf between $25,000, which really is I don't care money, and suspension, which is virtually the reason you rather point out Rebecca, the death penalty. There's got to be some way to, because of all of the collateral consequences, there's got to be some way to scale the punishment.
So, Tom,
that requires more accounting expertise than I have, which is enough. But I am interested in trying to figure out a way to scale how we manage this issue.
This is Susan, and so you're engaging in what we engaged in for several days a few weeks ago, which is trying to make our, make the statute fit our desires. And that's where this table came from. I don't think what you're saying works, because the way we've described the cap is really a one-time measurement. It's an aggregate basis. So if they're off a couple of days or a month or so, but they come in at the end of the year on the measurement and the cap is met, then they've met it. So I don't know how we could do it on a daily or a weekly or even a monthly. I don't think that fits. So what we thought was, well, we could try to do it by the size of the gap. And if it's, you know, less than 1%, it's X dollars. And those dollars go up. That's where I have to say I balked, and I think the other lawyers in the room kind of balked in terms of what the statute says. It doesn't really give us that ability to treat each percentage over an additional violation, which is kind of what you'd have to say. So that's where, you know, we tried to get and we couldn't. So I agree with you. I think ultimately, if we see a lot of violations of this, we are going to have to hope that the legislature will deal with it. But I think Candace made a great point, and maybe I'm naive, and it wouldn't be the first time, but as we go through this year, and if we see some of these operators, and it looks like we're only going to have a handful, four or five operators, and we see that some of them are missing the mark every month, then I think this idea of woodshedding them, if you will, or telling them, look, we do have this hammer of a suspension or a refusal to renew the license, and we're going to use it if we think you are intentionally violating this. And I think, again, and I've said this a lot, so forgive me, but I think let's give it this year and let's see how it goes. And if we do have this sort of them flipping their, you know, noses at us and saying we're happy to write the check, then we are going to have to either go to the legislature and try to get something changed in the statute, or we're going to have to start using the more nuclear options. And then, you know, again, it may mean a rocky first year, but I think that's probably what we're left with.
I agree with Tom. I wish there was something between $25,000 and suspension, but we had a whole bunch of pretty good lawyers trying to figure that out, and they kept saying to me, no, you can't do that. So.
And if I might be able to add, this is probably either helpful context or very unhelpful context.
It's Danielle.
If you look at the revenue reporting that we're seeing coming in from Colorado, Colorado is a state whose law became effective on May 1. And so they essentially had the good fortune of being the first to navigate, launch during COVID. And as their revenue reports are now published on their website, and they have an absolute terrific team that's already actually had an afternoon Zoom call with all of us and sharing their experiences. But to my point, the revenue reports that they saw from June, they did $25 million in handle. $6.5 million of that was from table tennis. But you also saw the event breakdowns. Their hold at that point was somewhere around 10%. The next monthly report that came out had, I guess what you could call, a few more normal sports in the mix. Still not full swing, but, and this isn't a state without a cap, just typical trading, the hold was then somewhere around a little over 9%. You know, with that, obviously I have to add the caveat in the context of these are month-to-month reporting, it's based on cash. You know, when you see NFL wagers in July, without NFL and in a state that was not taking wagers during the last NFL season, you know that those are all futures. So you have to account for the fact that those bets will be unsettled. But, you know, given that, you know, taking that circumstance into, you know, I guess considering that as you consider the context of that, this is a state with, you know, completely uncapped that is already showing that the hold is coming in around 10 and 9%. Again, kind of an anomaly of a situation because we might have some events that aren't your typical events, but that being said, in looking at what they're doing, I don't think that, you know, operators out there are obviously just giving away the farm and holding willy-nilly. They've developed a business plan for trading in that market, and we're seeing 9 and 10%.
If I might add to something Danielle just said, not only have we had long conversations with each of our counterparts in Colorado, Indiana has been amazingly helpful to us. Everybody who's doing sports betting has been helpful, but Indiana and Colorado in particular have been very, very helpful to us as we have looked at any of the issues that we have facing us. You want to add any other jurisdictions?
New Jersey as well. We've spoken to a lot of our counterparts in the different states, but you know, the folks in Colorado, Indiana, and New Jersey. New Jersey was instrumental. The first time I was on the other side of this, back when West Virginia was actually only the fourth state to launch a program, the New Jersey DGE was super helpful to us in those efforts because they'd been doing iGaming since 2014. But the efforts of Dan Hartman, the director of the Colorado Gaming Division, and Sarah Tate at the Indiana Gaming Division, all of them have just done a tremendous job in implementing their programs and seen a lot of success from it. And we're super grateful for all the support that they provided to us, you know, especially in the last 2 months since I've been here.
Are there any other comments or questions?
Susan, you have what
so
you need.
So it sounds like we're going to take a wait and see attitude.
Yeah, no, I think that Sam's suggestion is a really good one, and we'll take that up with the council tomorrow. And Don and Will are both here, so hopefully that'll be a short discussion. Thank you.
Let's move on to item number 6, which would be discussion regarding dispute resolution procedure. I think that's Alonda.
Right.
It is. So at the last meeting, you all asked me to kind of put something on paper that you could discuss about how you wanted to conduct the hearings on appeal that come from players who have not been satisfied with how the operator resolved everything. So that's kind of what I tried to do, is create a procedure. And you'll see the first part of the procedure just kind of takes you through it and tracks the actual dispute resolution rule. And so basically it says if you've got a dispute, then player, you got to go through the operator first. And then if you're not satisfied, then you can do an appeal to the CEO and she can look at it on the record or decide if she wants a hearing. But our security would do an investigation, and then she'll make a decision. If they're not satisfied, then they can appeal that decision to the council. And so the process starts on page 3 of your procedure, and basically it's a 3-member council appointed by whoever's the chair at the time, and then it allows for you all to do an on-the-record appeal or a de novo, as well as, you know, call witnesses. And then, of course, you know, they have the right after, if they're not satisfied with the decision from the council, to go to the board.
Are there any questions? Go ahead, Alonda. I think Alonda did a great job in drafting the resolution. My question is are we obligated to provide that many layers of review prior to them seeking judicial review at the Chancery Court level?
No, I think the reason we set it up that way in our rules, I mean, because this comes through the rules, I think the reason we set it up that way in coming through the rules is because we didn't want it to go so directly from the operator to you all without having the ability of us to kind of be able to do some legwork and make it a little easier for you, was the thought process. So that's why we had that layer of going to the CEO before, rather than appealing directly to the advisory council.
Thank you. I guess just a follow-up observation at Sam Lincoln. I guess I'm just concerned that the bettor that has a dispute against the operator is somewhat obstructed or obfuscated. It seems like it's very difficult to get a final decision on your terminus with that operator. So I don't know how to fix it, but it just seems like it's maybe overly complicated in the context of the bettor himself or herself.
Danielle, do you know how it's been done in other states?
Absolutely, and this is pretty consistent with what
this
we've seen.
This is Danielle.
Sorry, this is Danielle again. I keep just speaking into the microphone and to the air like everyone's going to recognize my voice on the first day. But it's pretty consistent with what's done in the industry, and just, you know, having been on both sides and also having worked on the side of the operators, you know, 90-95% of these are going to be resolved by the operator. They have full-time 24/7 customer service teams. If they have disgruntled bettors, they're not going to bet on their apps. Quite honestly, there's other options. You know, customer service is very important to operators, and also making sure that, you know, any glitches or any issues that would require regulatory intervention are reported in a timely manner. So I think that, you know, what Alonda and the legal team have put together is pretty consistent with other jurisdictions and doesn't reflect any undue hardships or hurdles that we haven't seen. And there's certainly a great process both through each of the operators to report concerns, but also, you know, through the regulatory body.
And Sam, from what I understand, some of these are for as little as a dime, for 10 cents, you know, almost principal.
Rebecca, I guess, this is Billy, I got knocked off. And you may have answered it, I missed it. Are there that many disputes? And I apologize if you answered it, in jurisdictions that you've been participating in, and I know I heard the tail end of Rebecca, could be the dot, but did we get to that many disputes in jurisdictions?
I would say that probably between 90-95% of any customer service related issues or customer disputes are handled at the operator level in a satisfactory manner. And so, you know, especially in a jurisdiction like Tennessee that isn't a casino jurisdiction and doesn't have, you know, existing retail operations and casino dispute practices in place and traffic that's, you know, already going in and out. I don't think that, number one, we're going to see a great many, you know, customer complaints, famous last words, I'm sure, but, you know, but otherwise, I do think that this is very consistent with the policies that have been implemented in other states for issues that will rise to the level of requiring, you know, regulatory intervention and ensuring that, you know, the consumer protections and these bettors are, you know, having their concerns addressed. But you know, typically, I don't think that we'll see too terribly many, and I certainly think that this is consistent with what we've seen in other jurisdictions.
Okay.
Danielle, when you say 95%, that's sort of a meaningless number. It could be 95%, 1,000, or 100. Can you tell us about how many actual cases there are in those jurisdictions?
I can't speak with certainty about how many cases there are in other jurisdictions. What I can do is I can certainly gather that information from the other regulators that we've been in contact with, you know, especially ballpark-wise. Contextually, I'm not sure, you know, how we can match an apples-to-apples comparison with their numbers, but, you know, we can certainly obtain that information. I know that, you know, there are calls to the customer service hotlines that the operators, you know, operate probably off and on all day long, whether they amount to an actual dispute or complaint, you know, that might be another story. But for the most part, you know, I think that we'll be dealing with situations that are probably anomalies. And one of the critical aspects of the review of the internal controls and the terms and conditions that the operators have submitted with their applications for our review is a detailed accounting of their customer service practices, their customer complaints process, dispute resolution, their service teams, the manpower, all of the details of that. And so we'll certainly be going through all of that, you know, with a fine-tooth comb before authorizing any go-lives for the operators. And so I think coupled with what we have in place there, this policy, you know, should keep our number probably, again, like I said, fairly low. I can't answer the actual numbers though, but I'll certainly get some more information if that would be helpful from the other regulators.
My reasoning for the question was, it's just one thing if you have 10 cases to get to the council here, mm-hmm. and it's another thing if you had 100 cases, because that would sort of alter the way that we would have to deal with it.
Danielle said this in a more subtle way than I will say it. As I've talked to my counterparts about this particular process, they have said to me the last thing any operator wants is for a player to have to come to their regulator. They're afraid of the regulator having issues that then spread to every other place they do licenses. So I've been assured, again, Danielle's famous last words, that these will not be very frequent because it's important to the operator to try and resolve it before it ever gets to us.
Absolutely.
And I don't think you said that quite as strongly as that, but that's what I've been told by all of the gaming regulators I have spoken to.
You made a much more effective point, much more concisely, absolutely.
You were being nice.
I took about 5 minutes of their lives and they'll never get back saying something that could have been articulated much more simply.
No, but it's just, that's just good customer service, I think, and what you described. And nobody wants it escalated up to their boss, so I think that's good. Rebecca, do you, in your opinion, just like the previous item over the penalties, is this something we want to take a wait and see? And it seems like you've got a very good policy here, and for dispute resolution, take a wait and see, and then if as John states, it comes in and it's an astronomical number that's coming to us, then we look for ways, and Samuel said it too, to adjust the policy going forward.
I'm very comfortable with the policy as it's written. Haynes had just asked me a question about, does it come to me first? And that's a very common practice. When we have a dispute with a retailer, it comes to me first. And then when we rule, if they don't like it, they can take it to court, which is their next step, and very few have taken it, they're gonna take it to the board. And then the board will have a committee that will hear it, and so there are very few that go from what our hearing is to the board. And we would hope that would be the case, but uncomfortable as it is, and I'm always comfortable changing when something doesn't work. So if this isn't working, we'll come back to you all and go, whoa, whoa, we need to look at how we change this.
We need a motion for any of this.
I think so. Alonda, Danielle, Susan, somebody?
That's Alonda.
That's fine, I think it'd be good. That way we'll have it on record that, that they're comfortable with the procedure.
Do we want a motion? John Bellion, I'm sorry, we want a motion?
No, no, John, I was gonna say, does that suffice as a motion, John, does you wanna make the motion?
Yeah. Make that motion.
Is there a second?
Needs to be written. Yes, I thought we were talking about just adopting the dispute resolution procedure.
Yeah, that's right.
Alright, so we got a motion, Ben, speak to it.
Ryan, please.
Ryan, are you seconded? Gotcha, okay, so John's made a motion that we, and Ryan seconded that we adopt the dispute resolution procedures as presented, and is there any further discussion? Hearing none, all in favor signify by saying aye. Aye.
Aye.
Aye.
Are there any, is anybody in opposition? Any no votes? So that passes unanimously, okay.
Yeah, and again, we need a motion on the rule covering capped out pay, capped out.
No, that'll be taken up tomorrow at our board meeting. This is your dispute resolution, so we wanted a motion on it.
So we'll get a report then at the next meeting, which we're actually gonna decide at the next item, on what action we're gonna take, if any, which I don't think there is any, on the cap resolution. So, well, I guess we'll just hear a report from you guys.
Sure, and Susan wants to say anything about that.
I actually, I feel like we got consensus on the cap penalty discussion. If not, let me know. But I did wanna ask Alonda one question, if I might, Billy, on the dispute resolution. And this is just, I'm sitting here, you know, thinking, are players, where is it that a player is bound by these rules? I mean, could they, if they wanted to, just sue, or is, I understand how the operators are, but do the players agree to these rules themselves when they play?
I would assume they're agreeing to the dispute resolution process of the operator.
The operator.
Well, and the operator is required to provide the terms and conditions of using that app, all of that information publicly to the players. And essentially, when that player creates an account, part of the account creation process is acknowledgement that they are accepting the terms and conditions, they have access to all of that.
Yeah, and would this be part of the operator's terms and conditions, you think?
And so essentially what it, I think, typically says, and I can actually get you probably screenshots of the apps from each one of the applicants that we have to show you exact examples. But what it will say is that they agree to the terms and conditions and also, you know, the regulatory requirements of the, you know, the Tennessee Sports Gaming Act, and then they'll have the citation to that, the citation to the rules, okay. Mix, regulatory documents, et cetera. So it's kind of like a catch-all. But also they're required to make sure all of that is publicly available and easily accessible to their players as part of their customer service plan, and as well as the, of their player accounts, okay. And account creation component.
Okay.
All right. Let's do the final item before we adjourn and discuss, would we want to have another council meeting?
I would like to recommend, Billy, if it's okay, November 16th. Our board meets quarterly, and the next quarterly meeting is November 17th. And it has worked well to have a council meeting the day before our board meeting. So if you all could do noon on November 16th, that would be my recommendation. And by then, hopefully, we will have been up and running for a couple of weeks, and any issues that have arisen, you will be able to hear about, opine about, give us guidance on.
Does that seem to meet everybody's approval? Is there any comments on the November 16th?
16th. I've got a 3-day trial starting the next day. Is there going to be a reason for us to be there on the 16th and the 17th?
No, just the 16th.
And you can, it's the 16th for the Monday, so that would be in Tampa Bay?
I know it's a Monday. Yeah, what was, I didn't hear after you said it's a Monday.
Because today is a Tuesday. I just thought you were trying to do it the day before the board meeting. But
the board meeting's on Tuesday.
It's on a Tuesday. Okay.
The 17th.
Andy's trying to take a long weekend over here.
Oh, is that a holiday?
No. I was making a bad joke. Sorry.
The board meeting is on Tuesday, November 17th. And so I recommend this be on Monday, November 16th.
Okay, and hopefully that'll work out, John, with your trial schedule. It sounds like it will. Is that okay with the rest of the group, or do you have any comments on that? So we'll set that date then for November 16th at noon, and hopefully we'll be back to, God willing, we'll be back to meeting in person. And I want to thank the staff, always, Susan and you guys, for all your hard work. And I think by the November meeting, we would have been at this for about a year. And I think that you guys have done a great job. And I think we're all looking forward to Tennessee being added to the states that has sports gaming. And we hope for big success, and it benefits our state and our students as we move forward. But are there any other comments, anybody, any other council members?
Yeah, this is Kevin. I've just got one quick comment. Let's see, Rebecca, I appreciate your leadership in all these meetings and all these steps, and I know it's been difficult to get everything started. I'd also like to welcome Danny and Danielle to the team, and we appreciate Alonda and Andy's guidance every single time, and particularly compiling all of the notes and all the memorandum and everything that we go by to run these meetings effectively and efficiently. So I just want to thank everybody over there on that side of the house.
Well, thank you. That's very nice.
I'll second that.
All those in favor?
You like to make motions.
Hey!
If there's no other business before us today, I'll entertain a motion for adjournment.
Make a motion to adjourn.
John, and so we got a motion. I think John, I don't know who the second was, but that Kevin. And all in favor say aye.
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 And I hope to see you all in November. Thank you. Thanks.
We hope so. Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.